You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today,
that would be like my story of the century.
We conclude this year's rundown of the biggest stories in physics in 2020.
This would open so many doors for energy production and transportation, maglev trains. This is absolutely an incredible achievement. Of course, there's a hitch.
As chosen by quantum physicist Ian Durham.
It's amazing. This is really cool. What this is telling us is that we're seeing a quantum effect on a macroscopic level.
I'm Ziha Mirali. Hello again. This is the second part of our annual pick of the most groundbreaking advances in physics and beyond, as chosen by FQXI member and quantum physicist Ian Durham of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. In the last edition, we discussed some newsworthy items that did not get into his top five. So now, we'll find out what did.
Number five. So, rolling the drums here, we have an interesting experiment that tested a really interesting thought experiment that has to do with the very nature of reality. And what's better for FQXI than something that's testing the nature of reality? And it has to do with a funny little test called Wigner's friend.
Just to be clear, Wigner here is a person. Wigner is the physicist Eugene Wigner.
Yes, I should say that it's Eugene Wigner, who was a Hungarian-American physicist. I mean, he was Hungarian and then he emigrated to the U.S. And famous for a lot of very important things. Father of nuclear power plants, actually. But anyway, what the Wigner's friend thought experiment is all about is what happens when the observer himself or herself is also observed. Wigner's friend goes something like this. Wigner's got a friend who has a laboratory. Let's say the friend performs a quantum measurement. The question is, putting aside the arguments about whether a wave function collapses or not, so let's assume it does for the purposes here. So, you know, we won't get into the arguments over interpretation at the moment. Let's just assume that the wave function actually does collapse when a measurement is made.
When we talk about a wave function, what is the wave function? When we talk about wave function collapse, what are we talking about?
So, particles are also waves. And how do you interpret that? The wave function can be interpreted as a probability function of where a particle will be when you measure it. And so it's, you know, really just a set of probabilities. But there are so many other ways of looking at it, and there's interpretations upon interpretations of what it means. But that's essentially what it is. So it's a mathematical thing that describes the behavior, the dynamics of a subatomic particle as a wave-like feature. And when you make a measurement on it, that wave-like feature disappears and it acts like a particle. All right. So the question is so the friend makes this measurement and supposedly collapses the wave function. Wigner knows the friend is making this measurement, but Wigner doesn't talk to the friend right away. And later on, Wigner runs into the friend, maybe at a train station or something, and says, "Did you perform this experiment?" And the friend says, "Yes, I did." And, you know, "Did you get a result?" "Yes, I did." And the question is when does the wave function collapse? Does the wave function collapse when the friend performs the experiment, or does it collapse when Wigner asks the friend if he or she has performed the experiment? And the reason Wigner was interested in this was because this really had to do with consciousness, actually. He was interested in whether consciousness collapsed the wave function. That is still a wide open question. Putting that aside, a few years ago, Czaslaw Bruckner, who's also an FQXI member, whom I've been mistaken for before because we look alike.
You don't look that much alike.
It was at an FQXI meeting that somebody mistook me for Czaslaw when I got up and asked a question. But anyway, so Czaslaw came up with this interesting thought experiment involving Wigner's friend and entangled particles. It basically tested the idea of objective reality. His results were really interesting. They suggested that there was no such thing as objective reality. That's at least how Czaslaw interprets them. I'm not sure I totally buy that entirely. I have some interpretational issues that between me and Czaslaw. But anyway.
Between you and yourself in many ways. Then,
well, it was me and myself, yes. So a group at Griffith University in Brisbane performed a version of the Wigner's thought experiment, which also includes some co-authors who are FQXI members, my good friend Howard Wiseman and Eric Cavalcanti. It's funny because Howard's actually a theorist, but, you know, we'll forgive him for that. They actually performed an experiment to sort of carry out essentially something similar to what Chaslov had proposed. And the idea is to test whether objective reality exists. And so the idea is that you have a pair of entangled particles, and they are sent off in opposite directions to two different labs. And within each lab, you have somebody who can make the measurement. They're locked up inside their labs, and each of them is being observed by somebody else who's outside. And I don't remember what names everybody picked for these. I think Debbie and Charlie were the ones inside the labs, and Alice and Bob were the ones outside the labs, right? So Alice and Bob can know if the measurement was made, but not what the outcome is. And so that's an interesting question, right? So in the original Wigner's friend experiment, Wigner's asking if the quantum measurement has been performed or not. The question is does his getting the answer collapse that wave function? Well, this is a little trickier because this is looking at whether, in order to collapse the wave function, you're collapsing it to a particular state. And is it enough just to know that the measurement is performed and not know what the actual answer is? The details are pretty complex, but when you do this experiment, the idea is that, so Alice and Bob, who are called super observers, there's some inherent subjectivity to what they're observing, I guess is one way to put it. And so the way Chaslov sort of takes it means that there is no objective reality, because what Alice and Bob observe is completely subjective to them.
I wrote about this for Scientific American, and I remember we got into so many knots about how to describe some of the assumptions that went into it. And there are a lot of subtleties in the way that they define this. But basically, by doing their experiment, they violate some kind of bound that they have sort of invented. And it proves that these three assumptions can't all be correct. And one is that whatever theory this is, quantum theory or whatever is going on here, it's not local. So in a local theory, signals can't travel between particles faster than light speed, that there is no super determinism. So they're assuming the experimenters are free to choose what to measure without being influenced by events in the future or the distant past. And then this is the one that, you know, everybody that I interviewed for comment about this got into a knot over exactly what was meant here. But the other assumption is that when an observer makes a measurement, the outcome is a real single event in the world. It is not relative to anyone or anything. That was the wording that we finally settled upon to describe what they were actually testing here. And so one of the suggestions here is the fact that they got the result that they got suggests that that has been violated.
Yes, yes. And the reason for that is because I don't think there's a whole lot of doubt that quantum mechanics is non-local. It's pretty obviously non-local. The superdeterminism thing, the no superdeterminism thing, is very interesting. Superdeterminism is basically this idea that everything is predetermined. Quite frankly, superdeterminism is very, very, very hard to test. So basically, this is a question of free will. That's why they focused on this objectivity. It said that, well, one of these three assumptions had to be wrong, and the objective nature of reality must be it. But I will say this. I think it would be very interesting if Chaslov or Marcus Mueller is listening to this. Marcus Mueller did a really interesting paper based on an FQXI essay, I believe, where he looked at how objective reality can evolve out of subjective observer states. And I would be interested in seeing the two ideas, I think, could come together. Because if you're denying objective reality, are you denying it at the observer state level, or are you denying it at the larger level? Because I think I'm a firm believer in objective reality. Because you should get your vaccine, okay? Vaccines work. That is objectively real. Get your vaccine. I have some issues with the interpretation of this. I'm going to take a moment to just sort of push something that I've tried to propose that nobody seems to think is very interesting, but I do. The key is that eventually Alice and Bob find out the results of the measurements, because the door of the laboratory opens and Charlie and Debbie report the results. What if you take one of these labs and you drop it into a black hole? So Charlie takes the measurement. Alice knows that the measurement's been made, but doesn't know what the result of the measurement is yet. Before they have a chance to check the results, Alice and Bob, one of those labs goes past a horizon, falls into a black hole or whatever, which makes it impossible for Alice to ever know what the results are. And I think that's an interesting question to ask, but no one else seems to think that's interesting. So anyway, who knows?
I like it.
But anyway, that's the result. That's number five in the list. It's this testing of the Vigner's friend.
I was just going to say, I'm going to put a link to that article on the website, fqxi.org/community/podcast, just because this is one of the most fun ones that I have ever written. Not just because it's a really exciting piece of work and a great experiment, but I spoke to a lot of people for comment and I got a huge range of responses to this one. And it ranged from, you know, people talking about how exciting it would be and it could one day be used to test whether artificial intelligences have consciousness. And, you know, the other extreme, I had people going, this is not a test of Vigner's friend at all. How can you call, because it's based on photons, really. And Charlie and Debbie are photons in this experiment. And it was sort of like, how can you call a photon a friend? That is ridiculous. I spoke to a whole bunch of people, you know, really strong supporters of different types of quantum interpretations that we will not get into now. And if you want to learn more about them, then go back and find our podcast from, I think, last year, interviewing Renato Renner, because that goes into all the different kind of quantum interpretations. But what I did love was that a lot of them kind of came along and said, well, this doesn't tell us anything new. We know all of this already. And the reason we know it is because my favorite quantum interpretation is right.
Yes.
And, you know, each of them so strongly, you know, believe that. And so it was sort of like, well, you know.
That is quantum foundations in a nutshell. And this is, I think, partly why I couldn't get anybody to think about my black hole thing, is because they all have their own little thing that everybody's very, you know, this is my interpretation and this is what it says and whatever. So anyway, so that's number five.
That's number five, right. Okay, so testing whether or not we have objective reality only made it to number five.
Yes, only.
Only number five. So what is number four?
So number four is a recent result from another FQXI member and a friend of mine. Like, again, I'm not biased. I try to focus on things that are slightly more foundational, because this is the Foundational Questions Institute. So Bob Kuka, Bob is one of the coolest guys I know. Bob is a researcher at Oxford University and does a lot of category theory, which is it's mathematics. I dabbled in it briefly. One of my math colleagues in the math department at my place of employment told me that it was too abstract for him, and he's a mathematician. So that's how strange category theory is. Anyway, Bob uses category theory to analyze all sorts of things. In particular, he's been doing a lot of work on natural language processing, which is fascinating because language is a strange beast. I mean, if you want to know how interesting language really is, go see the movie Arrival or read the short story by Ted Chiang. Language can affect the way we think. And natural language processing is really, really, really hard because there are contexts and things that we include in how we speak. And language is one of those places where experience really plays a role. I mean, tone of voice can change the meaning of a sentence. So meaning is really important here. And what Bob has done, they took a natural language processing task that was suitable for testing meaning and testing the understanding of meaning in language and whether quantum computers can understand meaning. And they tested this on the IBM machine that, you know, you can put in to test on. And they found it was possible to construct a task such that the quantum computer, the IBM one in this case, was able to discern the meaning of a sentence, which is really, really interesting and incredibly hard to do. From an AI standpoint, pick any AI movie. The classic one, the great one, is Ex Machina, which is an absolutely fabulous movie. You know, rent it if you can. The question is could we ever actually build something like that? Could we ever build Star Trek's Data? It's extraordinarily hard to do. And let me just quickly say one of the reasons why this is true. So we think of when we program things, right? So every word is defined in a dictionary. So you think, okay, well, when I program up this computer, I'm just going to program in every word and every definition for every word. Go through the 20 volumes of the Oxford English Dictionary or whatever equivalent there is in Chinese or Japanese or Swahili or something like that. And you just encode it all. However, every word in the dictionary is defined in terms of other words that are also in the dictionary. Language is recursive. There have to be things that are self-evidently true for language to work. And that's sort of this meaning aspect, right? Meaning and recognition of things that are outside of the language itself. And so a meaning awareness takes into account more than just the language itself, right? Being able to parse meaning. You have to be able to sort of step out of the structure of the language itself because language is naturally recursive.
So let me ask you something. How do you test whether your computer understands meaning? Because I can ask Siri a question and it can give me a pretty good answer. What's the difference there? How can we test whether or not that sort of piece of technology is actually getting some kind of meaningful understanding of language? What kind of sentence could I ask, or what kind of question could I ask?
Typically, so this natural language processing, which is sometimes called NLP for short, is sort of a standard thing that is being developed. You mentioned Siri and Alexa and stuff, and that's what Siri and Alexa use. So they use NLP. It's a type of artificial intelligence that's focused on natural language interaction between people and computers. And so Siri and Alexa are focused on this. So it's not just a matter of being able to read and decipher language. It's also being able to deeply understand it. And classical natural language processing cannot do this. So like Data in Star Trek, even if Data looked perfectly human, you'd always say, I'm not sure Data is really behaving like a human. There are little weird things that Data wouldn't get about language. My kids, when they were a little younger, used to do this with Siri. They would ask Siri ridiculously stupid questions just to see what kind of weird answers Siri would give. And then people have also done things like they've taken Alexa and Siri and put them in a room and they've had them start talking to one another, and it just this endless loop of weird questions and stuff.
What could I ask a quantum computer in this case that, you know, that Siri couldn't be able to answer?
You would ask a question that has a very subtle answer. Like the example that he gives, you ask the computer the question, is Chomsky an anarchist? And, you know, the computer comes back and says, yeah, it's 93% positive that, yes, he's an anarchist. Of course, what that means is that the computer not only has to know what an anarchist is, it has to know who Chomsky is. That's a value judgment. It's not like one of Chomsky's titles or something, you know. He's not an anarchist title. So it has to actually think about what an anarchist is and think of who Chomsky is. And it has to basically extract meaning from the sentence. Let me take a step back, because the way you implement this in a computer is a little, it's not like you go up to the IBM computer and say, hey, is Noam Chomsky an anarchist? How do you do it actually? In fact, there's a quantum version of natural language processing that Bob has developed. So again, natural language processing is a type of artificial intelligence. That's an actual thing. It's a set of mathematical analyses that are used to facilitate language interactions. You teach computers what verbs are and how they behave in sentences and things like that. That's what natural language processing is. Bob and his group and a few others have developed a quantum version of that because, you know, everything's better with quantum, right? And basically, it's the idea that natural language has a structure that might actually have this sort of natively quantum nature to it. The way Bob explains it is he says, you know, it's like the language seems to want to live on the quantum. What does that really mean? I think it comes back to the fact that language is ultimately self-referential. You have to step outside it to really fully understand it. And so quantum systems kind of offer a funky way around some of these issues. Anyway, and what they did is they turned this into an algorithm, and then they fed the algorithm to the IBM quantum computer and were able to get meaning out of it.
So we've got computers that can understand meaning in language at number four. What is number three? Number three. I was going to say number five, but then we're going backwards in time. What is number three?
Number three is, again, on the quantum kick. I apologize to our listeners. I'm on a, there are a lot of quantum things on the list this year. Although this relates to LIGO, so the Gravitational Wave Observatory that discovered gravitational waves a few years ago. So LIGO is fascinating because in addition to being a great gravitational wave observatory, it's a very sensitive quantum experiment. It's basically an interferometer. It uses lasers and it has two arms, two long sections where two lasers go off in opposite ends, and you're basically correlating these two arms of the laser looking for the gravitational waves, and there are mirrors in these each arm.
So basically we've got these lasers, as you say, bouncing back and forth in two different arms of the interferometer, and they're bouncing between mirrors. So these are these photons in the laser beam, and they're bouncing backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, and they're going over huge distances. I guess the way that they detect the presence of a gravitational wave usually is they're looking for a really, really tiny distance, and you said it's like smaller than the size of an atom or something.
So it's an exquisitely fine-tuned instrument at the quantum level. I mean, really insanely so. And they've figured out that quantum scale correlations can actually leave a signal or a mark on the mirrors themselves. So you can interpret that as the mirrors are quantum mechanically correlated.
What kind of mark do these correlations leave on the mirrors? How do the researchers know these mirrors are correlated?
So you have massive 40 kilo. I mean, they're, each mirror is 40 kilograms. This is truly macroscopic. This is a 40 kilogram mirror. And they were able to show that the instrument's quantum noise could actually be reduced below an intrinsic limit that they thought existed, which suggested the only reason that that could possibly be true is if these large objects, the mirrors themselves, where the light is bouncing off of them, had to be correlated somehow at the quantum level.
What is quantum noise?
So noise, regular noise, is stuff that's introduced into a signal for whatever reason that clouds up the signal. So for example, regular noise in the LIGO experiments, they had to make these things so that they didn't react to trucks driving by or something like that, right? So if you see a signal, to be sure that it's actually a gravitational wave, you want to say, yeah, that's a gravitational wave, that's not a truck driving by. So at the quantum level, there's also noise that is based on the uncertainty of some physical quantity. In a system like LIGO, which is an optical system, the noise appears as typically what's called shot noise. It has to do with the discreteness of the electromagnetic field. So when you're collecting data, you're collecting a bunch of photons on a detector and you're counting them up. If there's no noise, you should get a very specific signal, but you never get that because there's always photons flying around. You know, like my lab is to be completely dark, completely black, because any extra light that comes in, it's a photon from outside somewhere that's going to get counted. Well, you can't get rid of all photons, right? You can't. You can't have a completely black room. So there are always going to be little extra photons flying in here that aren't associated with like the correlations or whatever, and they show up on your little data points, right? And that's quantum noise.
And then you're saying that there's some kind of limit to how small you can make this noise in normal circumstances, and they found that they could actually kind of squeeze down below that limit. But for that to be true, that means that these two huge mirrors have to have these kind of quantum correlations.
Yes, absolutely. That is correct.
So this isn't something that LIGO set out to test. It's just something that they found while trying to get their apparatus to work better or to do their normal experiments. So how exciting is it that they kind of stumbled on this discovery?
It's amazing. This is really cool. One of the reasons this is interesting is one of the great unanswered questions in science in general is, where does the quantum world end and the classical world begin? Because for the most part, we don't experience quantum correlations. We don't see quantumness on a daily basis. You know, I see one Zia Morali. I'm assuming that that's the only Zia Morali that's there. I'm assuming that you're not in many different places at once. Until you get measured. But what this is telling us is that we're seeing a quantum effect on a macroscopic level.
Okay, so now quantum effects are creeping into areas where they shouldn't be.
So now we're on to number two.
Number two
is a personal favorite of mine that I've been following for years. They finally found a room temperature superconductor. So superconductors are, of course, really cool. The idea behind superconducting is that at a certain point, usually at a very low temperature, but at a certain point, some materials behave in such a way as if their electrical resistivity drops to zero and they become superconductors. Typically, to get superconducting behavior out of materials, you have to drop the temperature down to a fraction of a degree above absolute zero, or very, very close. It's got to be very, very close. I think they've had superconductors now. In fact, I think one made our list once where they had one that made it up to well below zero, but it was, you know, it didn't seem quite as bad as absolute zero.
I've got here in my notes, I have here, current ones tend to operate at around minus 140 Celsius, but there have been reports of superconductivity at minus 70 and minus 13.
I think the minus 70 one may have made our list one day, because I remember thinking, wow, there are places on the planet where you can actually reach that temperature.
Yes.
Well, this one, which was done at the University of Rochester and University of Nevada, Las Vegas, they achieved superconductivity at a temperature of 15 degrees Celsius, which is downright balmy. That's warmer than it is outside my house at the moment. And this has been the holy grail of superconductivity for a long time, because there's so much you can do. This would open so many doors for energy production and transportation. Maglev trains use superconductivity, or can use superconductivity. This is absolutely an incredible achievement. Of course, there's a hitch, and the hitch is that in order to achieve this, they needed 2.6 million atmospheres. They achieved it at room temperature, but they needed a pressure that was just mind-bogglingly huge.
So this is the kind of pressure that we find at the center of the Earth. You know, if you need to be at the center of the Earth, how do you get that in the lab, actually? How do they do that?
They use a giant diamond anvil. It's like a clamp, right? So that's what it is. But this is a giant one made of diamond.
And I guess there was something interesting about the fact that it's made from carbon, hydrogen, and sulfur, or at least that it's made of three different things rather than two different things or something. That's how they think they managed to get more interesting characteristics from it.
Yes. Well, the caveat is a big one, meaning the 2.6 million atmospheres. Because the chemistry is interesting, they may be able to tweak the chemistry such that they can achieve superconductivity at room temperature, but at a lower pressure. Because the idea would be, Holy Grail would be a superconductor that you could just manufacture, and, you know, you wouldn't need anything special to use. You wouldn't need a dilution refrigerator to keep it cold. You wouldn't need a diamond anvil to...
But I want a diamond anvil. It sounds great.
I know, I want a diamond anvil. But, you know, you could just have it, and you could, you know, put it in your little piece of electronics, and it would work, do all sorts of neat things. The chemistry of the problem is what made it interesting, because there is a promise that they could be able to achieve something at a much lower pressure, which would be great. And it's the first time that we've ever seen anything at that high a temperature, regardless of the pressure. And that's pretty amazing.
I think you're a harsh judge. I mean, that seems like it could still have been at number one. But no, you need it to be at sort of atmospheric pressure, or it's just not good enough for you.
A true room temperature superconductor at a normal temperature, that would be like my story of the century.
So a very good effort there.
Good effort, but not quite.
Go away and try a bit harder and come back with a better result, and you might make it to number one of the century. But until then, what is number one of 2020?
Drum roll, please. Number one of 2020. Physicists have actually taken snapshots of a quantum measurement for the first time, and they found something very interesting when they did. So this is a group out of Stockholm, Sweden, and Sevilla, Spain, and Siegen in Germany. When you make a quantum measurement, so we talked about this already. We talked about the idea that it collapses the wave function, or that's one way to interpret it, depending on which interpretation of quantum mechanics you prefer. For the argument, let's just say it collapses the wave function. Because what happens when you make a measurement is it forces the quantum system into a definite classical state. You could have many, many, many Zia Morales, but then when I observe Zia Morales, she's in London. you know, even though before I observed you, you could have been in Rio de Janeiro or Cape Town or something like that. The question is that collapse instantaneous or not? So this has been a long-standing question in quantum mechanics for a long time. Well, a number of years ago, several people had developed the idea of what are called weak measurements. So part of the problem with quantum measurements is that when you make a quantum measurement, you disturb the system. And so that fundamentally alters the system itself. The idea of a weak measurement is being able to make a measurement without altering the system itself or with only minorly altering the system itself.
Just to clarify, when we're talking about weak measurements and you say that they don't completely collapse the system, they don't completely disturb it, they maybe just nudge it a little bit. But there's some trade-off to that, right? It means that I'm assuming the measurement that you take away is not as meaningful or as precise or as accurate as it would have been if you did a proper kind of strong measurement.
Yes, absolutely. So these folks used weak measurements they were probing the nature of collapse. So basically wave function collapse. And what this group did is that they used weak measurements to show that the act of measurement itself isn't instantaneous.
So they've done these weak measurements, and then how do they then show, I guess, that it occurs over a period of time? And what kind of period of time are we talking about, first of all? What sort of numbers are we talking about here?
They started with a laser. They're going to place an ion in a superposition of two states out of three possible states. Basically, each state corresponded to a different energy level of the ion's outermost electron. And then they have what's called a pulsed laser. It's not a continuous stream. It just sends out little bursts of light. And they use these short pulses from another laser to basically excite the ion from one of the three states, and it causes it to fluoresce. So it glows in the dark, whatever. In doing this, they were able to show that the collapse, they figured out, turned out to occur over about a millionth of a second.
It's quite long, isn't it, really? I mean, considering that there was a question of whether it was instantaneous.
Yeah, well, when something's instantaneous and then you realize it's not instantaneous, anything that's finite is... So yes, a millionth of a second. This, quote, gradual collapse, granted, it was only a millionth of a second, but the fact remains it wasn't instantaneous. And actually, a millionth of a second, that's a pretty long time. I think there may even be natural biological processes that occur that fast. I'm not positive. Now, I think an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to this, and as a quantum physicist, I probably should know the answer to this. I'm throwing myself under the bus here. You know, so you're doing this with weak measurements. Does it necessarily apply if you don't do weak measurements? Like, I'm not entirely sure it rules out all instantaneous measurements, but I'm not certain of that. There are probably people who say, take his quantum mechanics card away. He doesn't deserve to be a quantum physicist anymore because he should know the answer to that.
Now, we didn't get into this earlier when we talked about the Vigner's friend experiment, which was all the different quantum interpretations, and we just sort of said, well, you know, we're just going to go along with this idea that collapse happens, even though some interpretations say that it doesn't, just for, you know, the sake of having a simpler explanation for what was going on. And this particular experiment, the write-up of it, is framed very much in terms of quantum collapse. Does it matter if there is no quantum collapse? Would we still be able to interpret what's going on here in the same way? Well, I guess I'm sort of thinking specifically in terms of something like an interpretation, like a many worlds interpretation. In many worlds, when you make a measurement, there is no wave function collapse to one outcome at the expense of all other possibilities. Instead, multiple parallel universes appear, corresponding to all the different possible outcomes. Is this telling us that when you perform a measurement, I don't know, parallel worlds are created not instantaneously, but over a millionth of a second?
That's a really interesting question. So I'm not a big fan of many worlds. Please don't fire me, Max. I'm not a huge fan of many worlds. I understand why people like many worlds. It does seem to solve a lot of issues. But I would suggest that this suggests problems for many worlds. Because my understanding of many worlds is that the branching occurs instantaneously when the measurement is made and collapses to one particular thing. Let me put it this way. I would think the standard many worlds would need to be altered to account for this. Because the whole idea of many worlds, by the way, it came out of Everett's work. And Everett basically just took the wave function the Schrodinger equation literally and said that if there's a solution to the Schrodinger equation, it's real. They're all real. And so the only way to make sense of that, well, they must all simultaneously exist. Again, you know, how do you get there? Well, apparently it takes time to get there. And if it's taking time to get there, then you would think that either there has to be some interaction between the worlds, or many worlds is just a crazy idea. But I've never been a big fan of many worlds anyway. I believe in the one we live in.
Do weak measurements themselves make sense in a many worlds context? If you're doing a little bit of a measurement, do you get a little bit of another universe being created?
I'd say no. Right? Not to me anyway. They don't make sense to me. Another reason why I'm not a big fan of many worlds, because weak measurements are very clearly a thing. Mm. In fact, I think one of the first people to carry out weak measurements was Ephraim Steinberg, who's also an FQXI member.
You mentioned Ephraim Steinberg. I just wanted to mention that he also had a very nice result, an experiment in which he measured the time it takes for quantum tunneling to occur.
Yes.
Which was another sort of nice sort of a related thing. He did this experiment with Bose condensates, rubidium atoms, and he timed them tunneling through a 1.3 micrometer optical barrier. And that took 0.61 milliseconds. And again, it was just one of those things of trying to check whether something was instantaneous or not.
Yeah, which is another thing. Yeah, because that's a similar thing. We assume quantum tunneling until then, we assumed quantum tunneling was retreated mathematically, like it's an instantaneous thing. Theoretically speaking, you have a wave function and it has a non-zero probability of being on either side of this barrier. So that, you know, every once in a while, when you make a measurement, you'll see this thing on the other side of the barrier. So that's quantum tunneling. You know, we harness this all the time in electron tunneling microscopes. You assume the measurement is instantaneous, and boop, it's either there or it's not here. So boop, oop, there it is. It's tunneled, right? And what Ephraim showed was that's not true. It actually takes time to actually cross that barrier. I think fundamentally what all of these experiments tell us is that there's something deeper going on in quantum measurement. Quantum measurement is a much deeper thing than we thought about, which is amazing because it's already a pretty deep thing. I mean, it spawned 100 years of debate. Or maybe this suggests we're thinking about it the wrong way. That our current way of understanding quantum mechanics is not totally right. That we might need to think a little bit more about what that means.
It's a very, very quantum list, as you said. And that's fair enough, really, isn't it? Because we've got some great tests here about the nature of reality that perhaps we didn't think could be tested, or perhaps not realistically tested. So, wow, impressive stuff.
We're dedicated to the foundational questions, the Foundational Questions Institute. So while there are some really terrific experiments out there that happened this year and other results, this is pretty foundational. These are probing at these deep questions, as this podcast has shown. The last thing I would like to mention is something I promised a year or two ago that I would mention every year until we start taking it more seriously, and that is the climate crisis. Things have been weird. 2020 is weird. We haven't been going anywhere. So our carbon emissions have been way down. But we've not seen a drop in global temperatures or in the other things that we expected to, which is a bad sign because that means that the atmosphere may be oversaturated. I'm not entirely sure what that's going to mean for the future, but I just hope that we can get our act together because otherwise we're going to be in big, big, big trouble.
So there you go, listeners. We promised to cheer you up after a miserable 2020, and we did briefly, but then we decided to depress you again by talking about more future doom and gloom if we don't sort out the climate crisis, which I guess is fair enough as a sort of an important message. And then I guess we've also sort of added in that there aren't even any probably parallel universes for you to kind of dream about having a sort of a better outcome than ours, because Ian's not a fan. It is just one objective reality, and we're stuck in it, so we'd better sort it out.
Yep. We are in one objective reality. This is our objective reality. We better do something about it.
So Thank you to Ian Durham, as always, for his picks of 2020, details of which are on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. Congratulations to all those who made the list, for testing whether objective reality exists, showing that quantum computers may be able to discern meaning in language, accidentally discovering quantum correlations between giant mirrors, making the first room temperature superconductor, kind of, and demonstrating that quantum measurements are not instantaneous. You can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org, on Twitter at FQXI, or on Facebook at FQXI Physics. I've been Zia Morali. Thank you for listening, and from all of us at FQXI, we wish you a happy, safe, and healthy 2021.